Very cold, a high of 13 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight, bitterly cold, a low of overnight low of 6 below. Sunny tomorrow, still very cold, a high of 12. We should be back into the mid-20s for a daytime high on Wednesday and Thursday. For WGTD News, I'm Gregory Berg, 10 past 8, and the morning show is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. One of the most infamous names from the late 20th, early 21st century is that of Bernie Madoff. And surely you know at least something about the story of Bernie Madoff, who was arrested for massive fraud, a gigantic Ponzi scheme that ended up robbing his investors of billions of dollars. It sent Bernie Madoff to prison, and it sent many people into ruin of one kind or another. An absolutely brutal story on so many levels. And it has never been examined with such clarity and detail as it is in a new book called Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Untold Story Behind the Most Notorious Ponzi Scheme in History. Jim Campbell is responsible for the book, host of the nationally syndicated radio program Business Talk with Jim Campbell. And he knows this world very, very well and writes with an array of personal areas of expertise and experience to equip him well to tell this story so very, very well. And what the story does, what the title does not necessarily directly convey, is that Jim Campbell was granted unprecedented access, not only to Bernie Madoff himself, but also to certain members of Bernie Madoff's family. And that makes this book truly unprecedented in its scope. Published by McGraw-Hill, again titled Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Untold Story Behind the Most Notorious Ponzi Scheme in History. Jim Campbell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, Greg, thank you very much. That was a really nice introduction. And I got to tell you, I was born in Milwaukee. I grew up in the Chicago area. I'm proud that this is an NPR station. And Kenosha, I have to confess, was an area that was north of us about an hour and had a lower drinking age in Wisconsin than Illinois, so some of my friends mainly made some trips up there. So I know Kenosha well, and I know Wisconsin, and so it's a great honor to be on your show. And I might add also that the book was optioned for, and it's just out as of January 4th, Netflix, on Netflix, Madoff, The Monster of Wall Street, and it's also a tremendous job by the top director in Netflix true crime documentary. So I recommend that as well. I'm in that pretty extensively in each of the four episodes. So thanks again, Greg.
You're very welcome. And thank you for making mention of that series, which I meant to talk about. When we read your biography, there are a number of impressive firsts that you have managed to do, including managing to secure the first lengthy interview with former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer after he resigned from office in disgrace, and that's just one of a number. And of course, you ended up being granted amazing access to Bernie Madoff himself and to others in his family who have essentially not really talked to anybody else. Can you attribute this to anything in particular? I mean, what has allowed you to manage to snag some of these prize interviews and to gain this kind of access with people who often find themselves in very difficult positions and in many cases otherwise reluctant to speak with anybody from the media?
You know what? That's a really good question. I wish I knew exactly why, because in the case of the Madoffs, right, it was to get in the door was almost largely fortuitous, because I was doing an interview on my show with a woman named Lori Kandel, who'd written a book that focused on sort of the life of the Madoffs behind the scenes that Andrew had cooperated with and forced Ruth to. And she says out of the blue, do you want to talk to Andy the day before the interview on background? He can't talk. Obviously, he's being sued and threatened all over the lot. And Andy and I hit it off. And I started off attacking him on the phone. You know, your father gave you $3 million of money he'd stolen from his customers so you could buy a co-op in New York City. And, you know, shouldn't you be giving that money back? And he disarmed me by saying yes. And so that led to the coincidence that his mother at the same time was moving from Florida to Greenwich, Connecticut, where I live. So I said, Andy, I'll take her to lunch. And he set that up. And Ruth and I had a lunch, and she was a strikingly attractive woman, also disarmed me with just the way that she so readily, you know, felt the pain of all this, and that she was betrayed, as you know, just as victims were. And she hooked me up with Bernie in prison. We got approval from the warden, and we had 400 pages of communications by the time we were done. I got to be deeply inside this guy's mind, which is just unfathomable in nature. And, you know, I said, Bernie, this is your chance to talk to history, but I'm going to vet every single word you tell me. And he said, I accept that, Jim. And where this nets out that is so amazing to me is you have to remember that Ruth Madoff, Bernie Madoff, Andy Madoff, and Catherine Hooper, who was Andy's girlfriend, they could not get married because of all the legal issues, all of them trusted me to tell the story with their legacies, essentially, not knowing me from dirt. And they had no idea what conclusions I reached in the book until I happened to be on CBS Sunday Morning 2 days before the book came out, and they watched them. That's when they heard if I found that they were culpable. In Chapter 8, I go through, did they know? And the fact is, when I started, the Justice Department, the Southern District of New York, the FBI, the bankruptcy trustee, the media, all thought they had to know. And I did my own investigation, and they let me go at it. Now, of course, it didn't work out the way Bernie was hoping I would find. But, you know, that's how it happened. And I think one of the ways I do this is I'm a total straight arrow, report the truth. I don't come in with an angle or an agenda. And so they kind of grow to trust me. And other than that, I can't explain it, why you would talk to somebody like me who you don't know.
You are a radio journalist primarily, although you've certainly done plenty of writing. This is actually, I believe, your first book. And
first book.
In the acknowledgments among the many people you thank, I think it's when you're thanking your first editor that you mention floundering at first. And I'm not surprised, given, first of all, this was your first book, and for your first book, you were not exactly undertaking a simple, tidy topic. I mean, this is a complex story, and you were anxious to tell it well. Can you just give us a brief insight into just how difficult it was to tell this story, and maybe what kind of floundering was part of the process in the early going?
Yeah, you read it closely, and no one's asked me that yet. I have to say that's exactly right, because I had this vision that I wanted to tell the architecture of the whole story, which, of course, is all the Madoff, Bernie, the family. But no one had put together what I call the untold story, was how the system failed. And I mean the regulators across the board and on Wall Street, primarily through the feeder funds and in his bank. And how this all happened, and then, of course, the victims. And, so I've never written a book, and I naively thought, oh, I have an editor here. The editor's going to guide me through this. That's not really the way it happens. These are really busy guys, and they want you, or women. My second one is a woman. They really expect you to deliver a manuscript. So we're starting off with McGraw-Hill thinks the sex is Bernie. We want, basically, all we want is Bernie quotes. Now, that wasn't the book I wanted to write, and it was a very complex book. So I don't have the guidance initially, and I have really no idea what I was doing, to be honest. And here's the great thing about this. So I had an editing consultant who helped me a bit. I have this organization, the structure I wanted to do, even when I was told that they didn't really want to do that. I just kept doing it until I got the way I wanted to do it. And then some help in the writing, you know, going editing me and stuff. All of a sudden, it clicked, and I took over completely. I wrote every word of it. I wrote the structure. And, Greg, it was so bizarre. There'd be moments I'd be typing, and a word would come into my head that I would not know what it meant. And I would go look it up, and I'd say, holy cow, that's the exact word needed here. So something sort of almost mystical happens, or you have in your brain, you know, files that are hidden that pop up when you need them. But it started to flow, and I'm a very tough critic. I felt this is really good by the time I was done. So I was proud of it. McGraw-Hill liked it. And I'm just being very honest that I floundered for, you know, a bunch of months.
I'm not surprised, but I am impressed with how well this book came together. And I'm also impressed by how well you managed to tell this story in a way that can be penetrated by those of us who do not live in this world of high finance and investment and so on. I mean, just kind of the glossary of terms one needs in order to really understand the specifics of this story is really pretty overwhelming. And I commend you for telling this story as clearly as you do and in as accessible a fashion as you do. We're talking with Jim Campbell about his book, Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Untold Story Behind the Most Notorious Ponzi Scheme in History. Before we get into that Ponzi scheme, what it was, and its dimensions, it's probably important for us to talk a little bit about Bernie Madoff in a sense before that and apart from that, because you take great care in your book to talk about what he accomplished on Wall Street that was of a much more positive nature. You also don't spend a lot of time talking about this, but you give us a little sense of who he was growing up. And in particular, I want you to talk about this, a line where you say, Madoff grew up in the shadow of failure. And you're referring there to Bernie Madoff's father. And you tell us after your conversations with Bernie Madoff that he was driven not to end up like his father. That probably speaks to how he ultimately fell into this awful trap. Explain this facet of Bernie Madoff's early childhood and its ultimate significance.
I have to tell you that the Madoff Netflix movie or docuseries delves into the youth a little bit more than I do in my book, and I talk in the movie about that. And, you know, it's interesting because Bernie, he did grow up in the shadow of his failure, and it was shadowy, too, because he didn't really admit some of the areas his father's failed in. Many people don't know that his parents actually ran a broker-dealer out of their house, a business on Wall Street that failed. And he sort of covered up why it failed. But he had a sporting business, his father. And the thing is that Bernie had this burning ambition, and he was kind of a nerdy guy. And he learned at a young age how to manipulate because he had this, and I tell this story in the Netflix too, he has this girl, you know, and he's like 12, who knows, a very young age that he's trying to ask to play with. And she turns him down every time. And he goes to her finally and offers her, get this, a quarter to play with him, and she does. And if you look at his business, basically what he was doing with the feeder funds was throwing money at him, hand them out to bribes so they wouldn't ask questions and send their money to him. Now, you know, I dedicated my book half to my dad, and in it I said, I owe him for giving me the moral foundation that Bernie so sorely lacked. And that, in his youth, that's what I see coming out of this. Bernie himself admitted he didn't have the moral courage to get out when it was small because his mind was such that he had to be the guy that everybody went to, the guy that didn't fail, the guy that was perfect in a sense. And literally, it was easier for him to fudge, to fake the trading, than it was to say, I'm not really doing this, or I can't do it, or I'm a fraud. And so there was never a soft landing because of that. And I think he didn't have the moral foundation growing up. And the funny thing is, you know, when you're a control freak like he was, and you do everything in your life to say, I'm not going to end up like my dad, you end up getting out of control and you blow it. Because he built a business, Greg, from scratch that broke the monopoly of the New York Stock Exchange, that was 100% legitimate, that took care of his customers better than the typical firm on Wall Street, and was worth $3 billion in and of itself without any Ponzi scheme. And it's part of the tragedy of the story is that he could have been like a Bill Gates in that business if only he hadn't had a side of him that let him do this behavior of becoming the biggest criminal fraud. And I'll say one more sentence, because you're going to, and people in your listeners are going to think, well, you know, he had this great honest business and something went wrong. He lost some money and he got trapped in a Ponzi scheme. He tried to tell me a story like that that was very complex, so it was hard to understand, that he hadn't really told publicly because of that. And then you look into the story and you find this guy built that business on the 19th floor of the lipstick building, state-of-the-art equipment, MBAs, everything laid out like a Hollywood set. And then two floors below on the 17th, technology that was obsolete at the end of the 1980s, high school graduates, unsophisticated, he could manipulate. And at the same time, not after he had some loss, the same time ran the biggest criminal enterprise side by side with one of the most ethical. And that's the part of his brain that's so unfathomable to me.
Yeah, at one point, you use the term split personality. And it is sort of hard to sort of fathom what is going on there. But let's talk for just a minute more about this more positive aspect of what Bernie Madoff accomplished on Wall Street. Although we should maybe hasten to add that he tells the story that the Ponzi scheme was constructed and implemented rather late. You strongly suspect that all of this was going on decades earlier. We'll get to that a little bit later. But be that as it may, let me frame it simplistically that let's talk about kind of the before Bernie Madoff, the more positive chapter of his Wall Street story. You say this in this second chapter: Madoff spent decades nurturing a pristine and truly customer-focused business, which is not necessarily the norm on Wall Street. And you say this turned him into an industry leader and somebody who really shook up Wall Street in a really, really big way. Explain more about the kind of, in a sense, maverick he was. And
okay.
Go ahead.
Let me just say, what he was so that people kind of get a view of that. He was a market maker. And what that meant was he executed trades for brokers like Charles Schwab. So he essentially did the execution for them, actually creating the technology that allowed orders to be done over the phone instantly and executed, as opposed to routed in and all of that. And he always gave his customers the best price available, because that's where you can kind of screw around a little bit and not treat the customer well and put a little bit more in your own pocket. And we can talk about Robinhood if you want. That's a current hot electronic trading firm, and they actually abuse their customers to the opposite of the way they present themselves. So anyway, Bernie takes the New York Stock Exchange is a closed monopoly, and then there's these regional exchanges, and there's the pink sheets, which are sort of some of the illegitimate companies, but small companies, and they're all on pieces of paper back then. You actually had to call up. If you know, if Greg was a market maker, I have to call you up and get a price from you for this stock, and then I've got to call somebody else, and then it takes a long period of time to close it and everything. And what he did was he combined all of that essentially on a computer screen called the NASDAQ, architected that, and he was the architect of that with his brother, and he became chairman of NASDAQ of the board at some point. So he's executing these trades for customers. The CEOs of Schwab and places like that love him. He's offloaded all their operations work. He gives them the best price, and he's honest. And it was literally built from nothing. His initial investment was $5,000. He was at law school at Hofstra, dropped out, and built this business. He was from far, you know, Rockaway, Queens, about as far away metaphorically as you can get from downtown Wall Street. And it's all true. He built it up.
So one of the causes of this split personality, in a sense, is that while he is operating in this one area, he is also, you tell us, simultaneously building an investment advisory business to which he did not apply the same stringent ethics. And as you already touched on, he also used very, very different technology. And I should think that maybe to some extent the investment advisory business is that perhaps a sector that is a little less stringently regulated? I mean, is it a place where misdeeds are, in a sense, easier to commit?
Well, in his case, that was because the SEC was so incompetent. Let me just say that other business would be known as a hedge fund business, which people understand now. The difference in the business is the legitimate business, he's executing trades and he's making money on commissions, right? And that means the market's up, the market's down. He makes money. That's a business that he could run well because he could put technology, good people, and control costs. Now let's go over here to the hedge fund business. The thing there is you're investing people's money and you're essentially then taking bets on strategy, trades, et cetera. And that's where he got trouble with his mind because he couldn't accept losses. And he had some early losses, and he panicked over them. He couldn't deal with it psychologically. And that was the problem. Rather than say, well, that's a business I can't be in, I'm getting out of it, he was so popular, getting so many folks. Remember, this was 85% of Jewish affinity crime. So he was essentially taking his family and friends initially and his faith, where betrayal on a financial basis is sacrilegious, and he couldn't turn the spigot off once it got going, and he had to keep delivering. As to why it wasn't easily to detect, the first part is a Ponzi scheme is easy to detect. The trouble is the SEC was organized around the two businesses separately. So what they were doing was they did five separate investigations and never found it. They kept sending in the folks that know how to look at brokers and trading. And there, of course, we've already said he was doing that totally honest. The people that come in and look at it, an investment advisory business and understand Ponzi schemes, for instance, never, ever investigated that business. A, he didn't even tell them that he was in that business, and they didn't figure it out even when he was one of the largest hedge fund guys in the world. He was not registered. So they didn't have the right people looking into it. Otherwise, it should be able to be detected. Now, and it's a lot more lucrative business than commission business because you get 2% of the assets that you're managing and you earn 20% of every gain. And by the way, that's how Madoff did his bribes. All that money that should have gone into his pocket, he passed it all right back to the feeder funds who sent him the money, who were used to only making a small sliver of 1% of the assets, and that's it. So in return, though, they couldn't do their job. Their entire job is due diligence. Who do I take? Greg is conservative. Okay, who's a money manager that's conservative that I can match up his money and diversify? They weren't allowed to do any of that because Bernie wouldn't let them, but they pocketed. The biggest firm pocketed over $1 billion in fees, the biggest feeder fund.
And in a sense, he was, one way to look at it is that he was buying their silence or buying their looking away
I called it willful blindness.
I think it would be interesting to talk for a moment about a term that you at one point in the book call the front of the restaurant, because and we've kind of been dancing around this, but I think this term really helps a lot of us kind of understand more about the significance of these two enterprises going on simultaneously and how the one, in a sense, was very likely a front for the other. And so I just describe what we are talking about and to what extent you think it was consciously constructed from the start as a front for a less proper activity.
You know, that's a really good point, because I dealt with this with Andrew Madoff. People will understand this quickly, because I got that front of the restaurant from mafia comparisons, because, you know, the mafia may run a legitimate restaurant or some legitimate business, and then in the back, in this case, two floors below, you've got the criminal business going on. And so if you're totally cynical, you would assume that the reason he was so stringent was exactly that, because he was trying to cover up the dirty. And I think there's some subconscious truth to that. I also think he was dedicated to the business itself. But here's the thing. His two sons were put out front to run that business. They were essentially the maitre d's and used by Bernie to do that. Now, from Bernie's mind, what he was doing was protecting them from any complicity. From Andrew's mind, no, Jim, he was using us. We were the front. We were his front men to protect him, and he just used us. So you can see how you can look at it from both ways, and that's how Andrew felt about it. You know, I used to say to Andrew, and this is the thing about Andrew, people assume that they had to have known, right? When they found out that December 10th in 2008, the day before Bernie confessed in their co-op on the Upper East Side, when Bernie confessed, the two boys, they didn't think about, well, should I get my money out? Should I flee the country? Should I give Bernie a couple weeks to, you know, clean things up or close it down? No. They left the apartment and went to lawyers to figure out how to turn him in on the spot. And Andrew never said another word to his father again for the rest of his life. From that moment that afternoon when he dropped that on him. And I used to say, Andy, talk to him for your own benefit to get closure. And he would say, no, never. He's dead to me. So, yeah, he felt that he was used as the front of the restaurant. And it's very easy to understand that, because everybody knows how the mob operates.
So let's talk a little more about this so-called Ponzi scheme. And I think a lot of us never knew this term at all until the Bernie Madoff story broke. And even after that, I mean, it's still a little hard to maybe wrap our heads around this, unless this is a world in which one lives and really works. So just describe in general, kind of a dictionary definition of what a Ponzi scheme is, and then and then turn more specifically to the Ponzi scheme of Mr. Bernie Madoff.
Okay. Yes, because it's actually fairly easy to understand the concept, but don't feel bad that you think it's opaque, because I'll tell you, I asked Ruth Madoff, what's the first thing that went through your mind when Bernie finally confessed? She told me the first thing she said was, what's a Ponzi scheme? A Ponzi scheme means there's no real investment activity going on. The returns are coming from one set of investors and given to another. What does that mean? You always need more investors coming in the front door than are leaving through the back door when they take their money, right? Because you obviously need to keep paying off people. And that's why they fail inevitably, because you can never keep more money coming in, and you have to keep paying the guys that are in it, because you've told them, well, you're going to make 15% or 40%. And the way they make their 40% is by new people coming in the door and giving them their money. So that's what it is. That's all it is. No real investment activity. And now Bernie's version survived for so long because not only did you have the incompetence of the SEC and the regulators, and he bribed the feeder funds not to ask questions, but he had these big four investors who gave him cash sometimes when he needed it. They came to have the power to extort even better returns from his lesser wealthy clients. I call that a reverse Robin Hood. So it was able to sustain itself for much, much longer than it was. But it was ultimately what I just said. There was no real investment activity. They faked all the trading. They took this old IBM AS 400 computer and they faked the trades, ran out these beautiful looking statements that came out every month with nothing but well-known stocks on it, and chronologically ordered confirmations of trades behind it. You could go through each one and look at it. And it was just literally a fake scam. And he just kept accumulating money. And by the way, it could have been solved quickly in a couple of different ways. Number one, all that money went into a checking account at J.P. Morgan called the 703 account, which meant J.P. Morgan should have been able to look into this account. Bernie told him it was just an operating expense, you know, paying rent and utilities and stuff. But somehow $170 billion went through it. And his strategy was stock strategy. And so that you need to have payments to other parties who you trade with. So there have to be counterparty trades in there, payments, and there have to be dividends deposited because it's a stock strategy. Well, in the whole 40-year period, there was never $1 of any trade to a payment to a counterparty or a dividend deposit. There should have been $4 billion. So that should have been easy to detect that something was up. The other thing, Bernie told me himself, every trade on Wall Street has to clear through something called the Depository Trust, the DTC. It just makes sure that the funds are there and the stocks are there, and you can trace them back. And every single one of his market-making trades, the legitimate business, you could trace right through there. And the account number was 646. And he says, you call the DTC, you ask for that account, and you'll see there's a sub-account for the investment advisory business, and you'll see you can trace every trade, except one thing. There was no sub-account. There was no investment advisory trade ever through there because there was no trading. And the SEC did not make the phone call. He expected to be in handcuffs that weekend. So it's not conceptually tough, and it should be rather easy to uncover. Hmm.
Let's talk for a moment about something you mentioned in passing in that whole description of Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme, and that was the Big Four, as they came to be known, four really significant investors, and they were, in a sense, both the problem and the solution in this Ponzi scheme. I mean, it's really interesting the role that they played in giving Bernie Madoff the money he needed, the capital he needed, in order to keep this going. But then the money that they insisted on receiving in exchange, that was, in a sense, what the way Bernie Madoff says it, in a sense, trapped him in this scenario and kind of led to its escalation. Tell us more about the so-called Big Four and the role that they played.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. They were both kind of his salvation and his Satan, if you will. The biggest of whom, Jeffrey Pickhauer, and most people have never heard of him, took $7 billion out of the fund. Now, think about this. In a Ponzi scheme, the guy that runs the Ponzi scheme is the guy that takes the money, and usually he tries to leave town before it's figured out there's really no money left. But that $7 billion, Bernie only, in quotes, stole $800 million to prop up the legitimate business when the whole business was cratering. And so he was the guy that made the money. Bernie wasn't doing it for greed, but Pickhauer had to be, and he was a bad dude. I mean, he called in and dictated his gains. He called in and dictated his fake losses so he wouldn't have to pay money on the gains that he did take out in cash. And the $7 billion, they were able to recover, but they still left the family with about $2 billion. And the fact is that they came to have the power to extort. And, you know, I said to Bernie, why didn't you, you know, get out of this? And you know, he says, Jim, you've heard the old adage, keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer. And he hated Pickhauer by the time it was done. Now, Norm Levy, the number two guy, he liked him. He felt he was a father figure. He helped take care of him when his wife died, and yet ripped him off left and right. When he died, Bernie was the executor of his non-real estate assets. Levy was a big real estate guy. Bernie was the executor, you know, dispersed those. He stole $250 million and put it in his fund.
Wow. Now, as you describe the Ponzi scheme, I mean, the Big Four are certainly significant players, and then really different co-conspirators, as you put it, are some of the people that Bernie Madoff hired to work for him and to help kind of implement all of this. This is how you open this portion of the book. You write, Bernie ran the Ponzi scheme with a mere handful of not too savvy people, purposefully picked because they were fully ignorant of Wall Street norms and processes. And you go on to say a little later, Madoff had an intuitive sense for hiring people he could exploit. Tell us more about these particular employees and, in a sense, why they were handpicked and so ideal for the task at hand, even beyond what they themselves understood their role to be.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. They managed to enable and operate a Ponzi scheme for 40 years without figuring out it was a Ponzi scheme. But let me step back to this the brilliance in his, and it may have even been subconscious, ability to manipulate people. Because on the 19th floor, he needed honest people, straight people, customer people, and would toe the line. And he knew on the downstairs, he needed people that would do whatever he wanted. He was hiring both of those profiles. And down below, there was another layer that I don't even know if he recognized, but he found several of the women came from abused backgrounds. So they were particularly looking to trust and were exploitable. And that's what he did. And he operated in three ways. Number one, he did run the firm like a family. So if you were sick and sudden medical, he would pay for it. He paid for honeymoons, and that was real. And the customers were real upstairs. He taking care of them. The second thing was he plied them with money, right? I mean, these are high school graduates. Frankie Pascali, his right-hand man, who his own lawyer referred to as Madoff Sammy the Bull Gravano and the chief fraud perpetuating officer, he came from only a high school background and ended up with a multi-million dollar house on a lake in Jersey, boats. He liked boats that were paid for by customers, a captain that was paid for by customers. He, at the end, he took his own bonuses out of the customer fund himself. Now, this is a guy that could never have done that anywhere else. Even worse, Annette Bongiorno, his right-hand administrative person, she ended up making $600,000 a year at the end with a $58 million, turned out to be fake, IRA. And she wasn't smart enough to have any idea what was really going on, but they knew they were doing stuff that wasn't kosher. You know, I mean, they thought the trades were not necessarily fake because Bernie would say, "Oh, they're being executed in Europe, and that's why you're having to just enter them here." You know, like making them up. But Annette was making up returns for to meet what the goals were, and she thought Bernie was her hero. She literally had a picture in her office of Bernie on a horse, like a knight in shining armor, because he'd gotten on a horse at one of the summer parties for the firm. And that's how she viewed the guy.
Hmm. You have already touched on the fact that that those who should have caught this quite some time ago failed to do that. I mean, failed. The SEC is particularly just missed so many warning signs, and certain whistleblowers were completely ignored. Explain how ultimately this did come to light and how Bernie Madoff ultimately was arrested and charged.
Yeah, this may not make you feel so good, but the only reason that he got caught was because of the 2008 financial crash. He didn't have a gate on his fund, so people could always take the money out when they needed it. And, of course, there was a run on the bank. $6 billion were out of it. Bernie confessed to me he never had more than $5.9 billion on deposit at any one time out of that $65 billion. So he ran out of money, essentially. And he kept trying to get money. One day before he confessed, he took $2.5 million from a friend to invest in it. So he was trying until the end, but he was so stressed out that he actually wanted, I think, to get caught by the time it ended. But absent that, I think he'd still be in business today. So it's not because the regulators or something just got smart. It was that it was a once in a century financial crash that brought an end to it.
Hmm. One of the things that's interesting about the way you put your book together is that you, in a sense, start at the end and you describe those chaotic, frantic, frenetic final days and final hours leading up to Bernie Madoff's arrest and the immediate aftermath of that. And much of what we learn about what life was like in that office as everything came crashing down comes from the accounts of his longtime loyal and faithful secretary, who in a sense becomes one of the few sort of heroes or heroines in your book.
Yes.
Tell our listeners yes. about her and about yes. the what she described to you and what a value she ultimately was in all of this.
Yeah, Eleanor Spoleri was there for 3 years. And another example completely devoted to Bernie, she was a victim of abuse by her father. And her mother actually left them almost in the street. So father ended up bringing her up, and he was very brutal with her, and the second wife hated them. And so she grew up in family betrayal. So she joins Bernie's firm, which is literally just Bernie and his brother when it started, and is adopted almost like she's part of the family. She had found her family, only to, of course, end up with another unbelievable betrayal. But here's the thing with Eleanor. Because I compare her with Annette Bongiorno, who I just explained was the woman administrator down below who had the $58 million fake IRA and was making $700,000. Eleanor came in the same time, also a high school graduate, and she was getting $125,000 a year with no IRA, and she was totally honest. And Bernie needed her to be totally honest and to do that. And so she was just racked when this thing blew up in internal stress as to what is it that made her close friend Annette go one direction and her go another direction. And she could, it just used to torment her. And yes, this is an amazing thing to me. So she's completely loyal to Bernie. This thing blows up and she has absolutely no knowledge of it. And all these victims are calling in, and they've lost all their money, many of them old, so bad that Eleanor was on the phone, was having to go throw up in the bathroom every 20 minutes. And yet the next day, after the FBI raided it, she is completely dedicated to giving the FBI everything that they need. She knew where everything was, and literally turned to the government and dedicated basically since then almost to try to make sure the victims get justice. And you ask yourself, wow, someone who's basically been betrayed at that level and is able to walk away from it and do the right thing while, you know, downstairs they were covering up and they were trying to destroy stuff and they were lying.
Hmm. There's one really interesting detail that comes up, which is that as she is on the phone with one of these, you know, frantic investors who as far as they know have just seen all of their life savings disappear in an instant as all of this comes crashing down. At one point she calls to somebody else in the office, and it's because the fax machine has once again run out of ink because so many people are trying to contact the office and the fax machine is running out of ink. And you just think about every one of those inquiries from somebody else desperate to find out information about what has happened to their investments.
You know, the way the process works is if you want to close your account suddenly, you have to send in, and that period was fax. You had to do it. And so that they were all, you know, all desperate, all trying to get their money out, which also, you know, Eleanor had no power to do anything about that. So she felt so helpless. And yes, you know, because a lot of these people, see, there were people I heard, this is nothing, there was a perception. These were all rich people and they got screwed. So who cares? You know, but then, no, that's not true. He had investors that had been there for 40 years, putting essentially their savings there. And it was their de facto pension, if you will. They were not wealthy people. And they accumulated money over time and a fair amount of money. And those were the people, and they were, in essence, using that as, okay, I'm taking out, now I'm retired now, so I'm taking money out of there to pay my expenses because I built up a nice nest fund, nest egg, and that essentially disappears overnight. And they even go after their houses at some points to try to recruit money.
Hmm. And you tell us that that some of the people who essentially lost everything actually were driven to end their lives by suicide. I mean, they are in such desperate straits. And I have to say that one of the unhappiest chapters in your book, chapter 7, The Abuse of Power, talks about, in your words, the way in which Madoff victims were victimized again by the recovery process after they were wiped out by Madoff. We don't have very much time, but briefly, can you just describe this really painful chapter in all of this?
Yeah, and people will relate to the concept. Everybody knows what the FDIC is, and if a bank goes down, the bank's paid insurance, and they have money there, and you get money back up to where the insured level was. That on the Wall Street, that's called SIPC, S-I-P-C, okay? So the crash comes with Bernie. They don't have much money in that fund because they hadn't fairly allocated what the firm should be paying. So here's what they did, which to me is just so unconscionable. So the money's not there to try to recoup it. So what do they do? They say Madoff victims that took their money out all the time, so they took more out than they put in, which would be someone like Picower, obviously. And then there are Madoff victims that never took their money out. They just kept it for savings. They said, we're going to get money back by going after the Madoff victims that took more money out, even if they didn't have that money any longer. They spent it. And we're going to take their money, and we're going to give it to the Madoff victims who left their money there. So in other words, these Madoff victims were victimized again to help pay other victims. And this trustee that was overseeing this took $2 billion in fees and expenses to do that process and go get that money, which involved threatening the heck out of people to get them to give money back. And so that's how these guys were victimized again. The government, the SIPC, the FDIC equivalent, they didn't pay any of these guys back the money. They got it from other Madoff investors to give. And I call that a reverse Ponzi scheme.
Right. Yeah, that's just monstrous. And we'd shake our head in wonder. In our last minute or so, have we learned the most important lessons that we need to learn from the Bernie Madoff catastrophe?
Yeah, you know, in my mind, the big overall lesson is, first off, throw away all the financial complexities, Ponzi's. This is a morality tale. It's the right path versus the wrong path. It's do the right thing. The second lesson is, I took this from the medical profession, the Hippocratic Oath is do no harm. You're an individual. Your first step is do no harm. Don't invest in stuff you don't understand. Don't invest in stuff that's too good to be true. Don't invest in stuff because your dentist told you to. Get into a low-cost index fund and put a little in and save. So the morality tale, it's don't do irresponsible stuff with your own finance. Don't assume the government's going to find it. The SEC is going to do it. SIPC's going to pay you. Those are harsh realities, but you're going to have to think about taking care of yourself. And aside from all that finance, do the right thing, because all these guys that made all this money downstairs in the 17th all ended up in jail and broke. So it wasn't even worth it. And Bernie's family, two suicides, now 150-year prison sentence. The wife left with nothing. It's a morality tale. It's a Shakespearean tragedy.
It really is. And you tell it very well. The book, again, is Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Untold Story Behind the Most Notorious Ponzi Scheme in History, published by McGraw-Hill, the author, Jim Campbell. Jim Campbell, congratulations on telling this important and complicated story so very well. And thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Greg, it's my honor. Let me just tell you, it means the world to me when someone does the level of research that you've done. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College pays his first monthly visit to the program in 2023, and we will be spending a portion of the hour paying tribute to a colleague of his and ours from Carthage, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, who unexpectedly passed away a few days ago. We will talk about Yuri Maltsev, his remarkable and unique life, and all that he offered to the